We had such a big episode this time. I think we've got to be careful that the intro doesn't become longer than the episode. So let's touch on the really high level things.
Well, we kicked off talking about ourselves selfishly, but then the big news of the week was the resignation of the CFO from Canva. So we talked about that a little bit.
Then we discussed the news of Ansarada being acquired for $263 million.
Yeah, and some of the M&A activity with Altium receiving a takeover offer bid of $9.1 billion by a Japanese company.
Yeah, some big numbers. And a shout out to Harris Qureshi, who writes This Week in Aussie Startups, and also Eloise Keating on writing an article in Smart Company that actually then breaks down a range of companies that have raised money from Bug Crowd to Marco to Fat Zebra, Hatch, Gilmore Space, which is really great.
Yeah, then we spoke about the Apple Vision Pro and Zuck's response, counter fight back, and talking about their own VR product or AR product as well.
You can take the MMA fight out of the boy, but you can't take that one up.
Then we touched on OpenAI with their new features they've introduced.
Yeah, and that led into a great chat about AI and where it's heading and the exponential growth curve that it's on.
And in dealing with that, we're going to have to get really focused and really clear. And we looked at the Taylor Swift lessons that could be learned from that in homage of the great artist arriving on our shores.
Nothing like a Taylor Swift insight for founders.
NVIDIA earnings were going to come out, and so we talked quite a bit about the markets, and I put up some charts on where everything is either going or not going. A lot of charts are conflicting with each other.
Yeah, but another great Don chart visualization session, so thank you, Don, for sharing those.
We'll see if any of it rings true. All right, well, let's just get into it.
Sweet. Morning.
Sorry I'm late. I was on the phone with one of our portfolio, Jack. He's promised to send through some of that info, so that's good.
Awesome.
That's good. Never need to apologize when you're catching up with a portfolio, okay?
We were talking about enterprise sales. On a couple of deals, the internal IT team keeps vetoing because they're able to lie about their capability far better than an external provider. And we're just talking about how do you get past those people. I was reminded that one client, their CEO in my previous life, actually owned restaurants with the competitor that I was seeking to displace. And we still managed to displace them in the end, but that was a hell of a displacement. That was a hell of a relationship to try and get on top of.
Yeah, never forget that with enterprise or B2B sales, you're still selling to humans with all different incentives, and there's a lot of blockers internally.
I think what gets lost is you're not selling to a single human, you're selling to an interconnected group of people. And especially in B2B, especially in enterprise, you know those crime shows where they've got all of the suspects on the wall drawing angles?
Yes.
That's what the sales process should look like for every customer. And in any particular meeting, you should be listening out and looking for who's the person trying to kill this deal, because there's always someone. And if you can't work out who that is, you've got a problem. And you've got to then be able to work the chart. And before you're actually selling or trying to get a final contract, you've really got to be in there meeting with all those different parties, understanding their biases, understanding why they do or don't want you. And so, yeah, we were just talking about some of that. And enterprise always just takes longer than you imagine.
Yeah. And even when you do have that internal champion, understanding what they need to get the deal done internally and helping them through that process.
Yeah, so that was a good chat. Well, we've got a huge amount on.
My prediction is this is going to end up in two episodes.
We had a great event on Thursday with Adrian.
That was a cracker up at Prigian Beach near Noosa with Adrian DeMarco, with a little fireside chat to an audience of high net worths, investors, family office types. And I mean, always, every time with Adrian, there are just golden nuggets, and I'm so glad we recorded it to capture them all, and we'll split it up into little pieces that we can share.
Yeah.
What a cracker of a night.
I apologize to the participants because I kept asking questions. That's probably fairly poor form when you're supposed to be the host, but anyway.
Yeah, I created a post on LinkedIn with some of the insights I took away from it, so check that out if you want the kind of quick summary. It is always a struggle, like looking at the audience composition. It was, you know, later age, gray-haired, white male dominant by a mile. And so conscious of working out how to solve for that. But yeah, really engaged audience at the same time, like really good questions off the floor.
What was your favorite bit, Jack?
I haven't listened to it yet.
Jack missed out. Jack was unfortunately in Adelaide. And
The mayor of Adelaide. But we've got Vu is coming to my front lawn on the 11th. If for investors out there that are interested, because on this one, it's less about the Go One journey and the founder aspects. This is more about the transition into early stage investing and what Vu's been doing and sharing some of those experiences. So reach out if you'd like to come along to that. That'll be at Chandler in Brisbane.
Yeah, fireside chat by an actual fireside.
Figurative, literal, the fire will be burning, there will be chatting and we'll be beside it.
Yeah, so hit us up if you'd like an invite to that one. And then we have the May offsite coming up. So the Scaling for Sustainable Growth, 3-day offsite just over the border in very northern New South Wales coming up in May. Really looking forward to it. I can't wait to be back on the farm. And yeah, Jack, we'll definitely fly you up for this one.
Yeah, that'll be good. I'm glad the weather will be, it might even be a bit frosty then. We might actually need a sleeping bag.
Well, this one, so our host has agreed to put a big bonfire up on the house pad at the top of the hill. So it'll be pretty epic.
Yeah, so that's good. And then it's almost June with our London mission.
Yeah, and we have some announcements coming up. So if you're heading to South Start, there'll be a bit of an announcement on the first day from the Deputy Premier. So watch out for that one. But already ramping up the scheduling and got some good new connections actually joining the network this year. So the schedule will be pretty intense as usual.
Yeah. All right, enough about us. Let's get into some of the news items. I think where we should kick off is the really big news that came out this week was around Canva.
Yeah, pretty major news that's kind of consumed social media this week.
And a lot of different reporting. I just put together a little chronology that I thought it'd be worthwhile just quickly going through because I think it gives people some context. So as it turns out, on the 5th of February, it was told to the members of the finance division that he was leaving immediately. But this doesn't become public. People don't know this at this point. Then at 4:42 Pacific Standard Time, which is about 11:42 Sydney, The Information, a journalist, Corey Weinberg, releases an article saying that Singer's resigned and that Canva had told investors that the company made this change to set ourselves up for success for the next chapter of Canva's growth. Now, nobody seems to have seen this in the ecosystem until some local journalists have picked it up. And even that day at 1:44 PM on the 14th, Bronwyn Clune of Capital Brief released an article about Canva around the secondary market called Canva Money Talks and Walks. And I thought it was a really interesting article because it was positing with this big secondary sale, do people just take the money and run, and what does that mean for staff? But I think it was Tegan Jones of Smart Company that was first to release. There's no timestamp on the Smart Company's website, and I Googled how do you find the exact time that a thing was released, and I can't work it out. It was reported that Singh was leaving, but what was interesting in that article was that his Slack and Access was deactivated the same day. Now, later that afternoon at 5:25 PM, Bronwyn Clune of Capital Brief put out an article saying Canva CFO Damien Singh was stepping down amid an internal investigation. Then the following day, the 15th, Tegan is the first person to start providing actual screenshots of the messages that were in the blind system. Then on the 15th, Jessica Sire and Paul Smith then do another article saying that those messages have now been deleted. And then David Swan on the 19th did an article about how the posts about the CFO have disappeared. In Swanee's article, he puts, for a sector that often demands better of the media, members of Australia's startup scene need to be far more transparent, whether they're dealing with journalists or their own employees, if they are to be taken seriously as their economic importance demands. He also goes on to reference new initiatives like Grapevine, a platform for members of the sector to anonymously share their stories, are a welcome step. Now, everything went reasonably quiet for a couple of days. The reason why I've given a little bit of a blow-by-blow there was Simon Thompson of Startup Daily did a post, and the underlying issue that was put forward was around attribution. He then later deleted that, and in it he said, "I decided to delete my post earlier today because it was focused on an individual who I value as a good journalist covering the tech sector, where my frustration is actually with the institutional aspect of major media lifting stories from smaller companies without attribution. It's not about gender either, but journalism and recognition of effort. When you're a smaller player, you see and feel acutely when it's repurposed without acknowledgement by larger sites who, by virtue of their size, are seen as owning the story." His call out there was really around attribution. And I don't know about you guys, but I like to start the day with Capital Brief's letter of intent. Yeah. I think it's a great newsletter, and they are really good at attribution. They share articles from all publications, and it's a very helpful way for people like us to start the day because we find out things that are happening across the industry. Anyway, I'll just pause. I'll pause there because there's the Canva issue. I think it's also important to understand the ecosystem issue because I think journalism is incredibly important for this ecosystem, and what Simon was calling out, I think, has merit.
Yeah, completely agree. I think on the reporting side, shout out to Bronwyn, Tegan, Swanee, Simon. I think what for me, what's healthy here is the fact that this conversation is happening, the fact that I really appreciate Simon Thompson's post around this. I think the attribution piece, there was a comment from Swanee on Simon's original post saying that he had actually gone to attribute and mentioned the other journalist, but that was actually removed in editing because it's their policy at their publication not to attribute others, which I think of itself is kind of Simon Thompson's point, that the larger rags, the media, don't do that attribution.
And but, having spoken to a couple of journalists, just trying to understand a little bit more, I was surprised at how little control the actual journalist often has.
Yeah.
And the way sub-editors actually do the titles and how some of the stuff is modified post. So
yeah,
it's a complex environment.
I think the other takeaway from me, the work of, say, Bronwyn and Capital Brief, I love how they acknowledge, here's what we know, here are the facts, we're not insinuating any further, we just have these questions. I think that's really healthy journalism.
Yeah, Bronwyn in there made it very clear that we're not saying any of this is true, we are just telling you what has been found and what has been reported. If we then go to the main issue, which is Canva and the situation, there's Canva's handling of it. Now, I think we've got to be really careful and really mindful that we are some armchair.
Yeah, we are sitting in the stadium on this one.
We are absolutely in the cheap seats. So I think we just got to be really careful of that. I thought Canva's, whoever the person was going onto the blind site to do their post to those anonymous posts, I thought was good.
Yeah.
I think it was firm. It was strong. It asked people to please come forward through the channels, that they would be protected under whistleblower. Now, the original posting seems to have occurred because people allege that complaints weren't being listened to. Again, that's their allegation. A process has to occur, but I thought that first step was good. We've got to be careful around judgment and allow that to occur. But in the world that we live in, it's innocent until proven guilty, right? There is a process that needs to occur. There are things that you can and can't say. There are things that you will and won't do until those investigations have occurred.
Yeah, completely. I totally agree. I think, yeah, we are in the cheap seats. It's hard to know from their perspective. These things move fast. Trying to get the information to make an informed decision would have been challenging. I think there's the handling of the allegations and the incident or incidents, but then there's the handling of the communication into market.
I myself have presided over excuses as to why key people this was 15 years ago, but I remember a situation where I was in a high trust kind of business and the relationships lived there and this person wasn't happy and they left, and And so you're coming up and you're scrambling with all these different excuses as to why that's occurred. But in hindsight, with the balance of time and experience and gray hair, all of this stuff always comes out. Like it's always going to come out. So get on the front foot. What really pisses people off is hypocrisy. And so the issue becomes is when your values are stated with a certain thing and there's all this rah-rah and all that kind of stuff. And then a rubber hits the road situation occurs, that when you then look at communication and how it's been managed and you map it back to the values. But having said that, entrepreneurialism is a mire of puffing up your feathers. The entrepreneurial energy, the style, if you look at entrepreneurs, they look at the world through the way they want it. Like in Walter Isaacson's book about Steve Jobs, they talked about his reality distortion field.
Yeah.
That wasn't just Steve Jobs. That's entrepreneurs. And depending on where you are in the scale depends on how distorted that field is. But when you talk with entrepreneurs, they talk about what they want in the world. They talk about what they want to be as if it's already occurred. Now, after a while, and a lot of people that work for these high entrepreneurial companies that then learn the truth of the actual reality of it, from the outside, people then get a little bit surprised. But actually, this is a life cycle location issue. People, I think, have a tendency to believe, well, if you're a $40 billion unicorn, you've got all this stuff sorted out. Well, no, in the life cycle, they are still very early on of high flexibility, still developing control, predictability, all of those kinds of issues. Now, why I like the life cycle model that we utilize is that it maps out different things that occur. And the adolescence phase is brought on by things going bang, by things turning to custard. And what then happens is it forces the company to grow up. The issues inside the company starts to become public. And then what starts to happen is systems and processes and controls. And this may be one of those things that occur, but the expectation that because they're of a certain size or a certain market cap, well, actually, none of that really matters from an organizational life cycle point of view.
Yeah, really good point. I think, you know, if there's a takeaway for founders, managing the how more than the what, like managing how you manage the incident itself is actually the critical part.
And Lucy Wark did a good post, I think. She put forward, look, we've got to wait for all of the dust to settle, the investigations to occur. She put a good question that, you know, their initial communication smelt like a cover-up. And when it all comes to an end, understanding why they chose that path is going to be interesting and a good lesson. Jack?
Just like speaking internally, the whole media side of thing, I don't really have a view. That's the journalists doing their own thing. But for founders, there's going to be a lesson here.
I think too, you know, a lot of the work Don does with the portfolio in change loop management and crisis management and having those tools in place as an organization, the structures and the trust and respect so that when something like this happens, you're better placed to respond to it.
But here's what happens with the life cycle though, and humans in general, we wait until there's a burning platform. We wait until an issue's happened before we go and get those systems, processes and controls. And some of the articles talk about the company's culture and some people snipe at it that it's cult-like. That's what early stage businesses are. These entrepreneurs come out that people like to follow, that they'll generally often work for lower remuneration for to be part of that culture. In reality, behind doors, behind all of the stuff, to build a business, it takes benevolent dictatorship. It takes a certain energy. When your back's against the wall, you're not coming out baking scones and it's all beer and Skittles. There's a certain energy required to build a company of this size. And that's why benevolent dictatorship is the words. Outright dictators can't build much. People that are too benevolent, they don't build much. It's the combination of benevolent dictatorship that builds stuff. And a lot of people will probably recoil at that. And we'll get to some recent mail. The problem is whilst benevolent dictatorship gets a business off the ground, that then becomes a liability at a certain point. And we just see this cycle time and time again, whether it's Elon, whether it was Steve Jobs the first time with Apple when he was ejected. These are cycles and these are patterns And what I enjoy doing is just pointing out these patterns. Yes, larger corporates that have gone through all of this life cycle stuff, have been through the adolescence phase, transitioned from founders, had the near-death experiences that bring systems, processes, and controls. They then move up that life cycle where predictability becomes easier. They don't have all of that crazy culture side. But you don't build a unicorn that is a global behemoth without certain types of energy, but that energy's hidden often from the outside world. It's hidden through veneer and PR and nice values that stand on the wall. But you go and work for one of these, it's the same patterns. Anyway, I think yesterday an article then came out from Bronwyn of Capital Brief, which I thought was quite good because it posited this idea of toxic positivity. And in the article, she says, what has been striking to see, though, is the way Canva's insiders have closed ranks around the company. Canva has a very strong internal culture, as noted, but some observers of the business are now wondering whether the culture, in a way, is too upbeat. Toxic positivity is the phrase that was heard. Employees that contacted Capital Brief were reluctant to comment on the situation. I'm kind of scared was the way one described it. When people did open up, it was only on the condition of anonymity, but they painted a consistent picture, a company that prides itself on stunning success, but also a place where criticism or complaints are unwelcome, frowned upon. Complaints, one person told me, were often a career ending. I'm not trying to excuse it, but this is a common pattern. It's sort of FIFO in these companies. It's fit in or fuck off. It's a, this is the way we do it here. And these cultures, as they get to this point, will start to come up against some brick walls where people will no longer be willing to tolerate it. But as we said earlier, they are cult-like. They have a certain energy. They're often run by fear. Like, make no mistake, in these early stages, they look like a blue-ringed octopus, looks all nice on the outside, but it's got some venom on the inside. Again, I'm not talking about what should be. I'm giving a view of the patterns of what we see. The problem is it's not sustainable. It happens and it's got a certain energy that builds it, but it's not sustainable. And then inevitably in the life cycle, something like this happens. The handling of it exposes a number of things. And then that ushers in a new world, a bit like the adolescence in the life cycle, in the human life cycle. It's now time to grow up. Now, what's the most difficult phase of the human life cycle? Adolescence. It's the same with organizations. Internally, there has to become a separation. The company's got to get its own vision and mission. It's got to be able to get its own systems, processes, and controls. A lot of internal conflict starts to come. And it's not age related. It's not size related. It's based on these different ingredients. Whether this ushers this in for Canva, I'm not sure. We'll see. We'll see whether this turns out to be a storm in the teacup for them and it gets dealt with. Or often what happens, it's the thin edge of the wedge and things start to come out. Now, as an Aussie success story, I wish them absolute best. We want to see them achieve absolute greatness. But what we do know is that toxic positivity after a while is a problem. We do know that the life cycle has a unique set of challenges. I wouldn't be arrogant enough to think that anybody from there is listening to our humble podcast. If they were, pick up Organizational Life Cycles by Ishak Adesis, and it explains exactly what's happening inside your company now, and it explains exactly what's going to happen in the coming period of time, and it gives you a set of prescriptions of what to do differently and not end up the way others have ended up.
I think there's a lot in there that we could talk about, and it's probably podcasts after podcast episodes. We could go deep, but I think, Don, segueing from that, like that toxic positivity, and almost this sentiment that some carry that we should all be positive. We should just be speaking positively about founders and positively about all these companies and not be like sharing the dirty bits necessarily or highlighting them or dissecting them. And you got some feedback from a listener this week, which I thought would be healthy to go through, just in terms of why we talk about some of these issues that founders face, why we talk about the shit bits. We're trying to offer value to founders, right?
So I got a listener mail. We love listener mail. We'd like more of it. But the listener mail was asking for some assistance, which we're going to do, which is great. And then he pivoted to your podcast. I've been loving it. The intergenerational banter is brilliant. And when I read that, I was like, hang on a minute, intergenerational.
And then three generations here?
Three generations.
I did have to do the maths to work out, is that a fair comment? And then I felt incredibly old.
Jack, you will find that in yourself, I feel your age. But then I do a Zoom or I walk past a mirror or then I realize who and what I am. So anyway, he said, the insights are fantastic, especially you guys talking through articles, Cut Through Venture Report, etc. But I do think you're shooting yourself in the foot with one thing, just one thing, I promise. The talk of shorting Tesla stock. I think that stance really scares away high-quality startup operators. The thought that you might dedicate a chunk of your valuable intelligence and money to trying to make sure that an entrepreneur loses money is really scary. Startup founders and operators want to believe that you spend 100% of your time rooting for their success, not trying to find ways to profit from their failure. That's my two cents. I think it's a bad look. Might even be a good topic for your podcast.
It's a great topic for a podcast.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening and getting to this point. Because this episode is long enough, and I'm not sure all of you want to hear the ins and outs of us discussing an item like this, I've shifted this to the end of the podcast. So then that way we can get to some of the news and the exciting things that are happening in the ecosystem. But for those that want to listen to the broader conversation of what we thought of this feedback and what we decided to do, it's at the end. So hang around if you want to hear, but let's get back to looking at news in tech and all the things that are happening. In other news this week, there's a lot of activity, a lot of M&A happening, and we saw Ansarada being sold for $263 million off to a US company.
Yeah, so after a phase of a bit of doom and gloom talk about M&A activity dropping, this is a positive signal along with some other activity in the market these past week or two. So, but great outcome, like $263 million. They are ASX listed and it's a US company, isn't it, from memory?
Yeah.
US company taking 100% stake of the business.
Yeah, something that I really liked was reading the article. They were founded in 2005 and it's just a great example of you just got to stay in the game, and they benefited from emerging technology like AI being introduced, and that enabled them to bring out new features like AI bidding engagement scoring, and that really gave them the valuation uplift to get a really good exit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they first started using AI, or at least the terminology, back in 2017. So
that's early.
Very, very early in that journey. But yeah, the 20 year overnight success.
Yeah. The video is kind of a similar story, right? Like they held on, stayed in the game, and then they benefited from the new tech.
Yeah, and shout out to the founders. And again, complimentary diverse team, Andrew Slavin, Sam Riley, Rachel Riley, Daphne Chang. Well done. Like, congratulations. Yeah. It's a great result.
Just triggered a thought. There was something I saw on some social media platform of a content creator or something winning this global award. And he said, I just want to let everybody know that for the first 12 months of my journey, I posted every day, 365 times, to one follower. There was one person on the other end, but I just stuck with it. And then after 12 months, there was a second follower, then a third follower, and now he's got millions. And a lot of this is the universe says, you need to be in the game for a certain period of time before I'm going to let you have a crack.
It's like a rite of passage. That one first follower, it's like, thanks, mum. And then eventually dad comes in.
And so 263 million is a cool number, but you know what's really cool? 9.1 billion, Altium, takeover from a Japanese company.
Yeah, and I didn't know Altium at all, but going through this and looking, we talk about niche and how nice is their niche, which PCB design software, which of itself, reasonably niche, but specifically for automotive and aerospace. I love it.
Yeah. So anybody that says, oh, we've got to go broad to build a great business, it's like, how many more examples in life do I have to give you?
Yeah. Admittedly, they do consumer products and medical devices.
Hey.
It's not like the primary focus.
They didn't do that at day one. Let's not ruin a good story with the truth. Calm down.
But a great Aussie company, like, again, they're these amazing companies that are under the radar in Australia. World-class tech and a $9.1 billion offer. Like that is massive.
Yeah. And there was a David Swan article that went really well into some of the details of this transaction. What it put forward was that the ASX actually isn't a bad place for Australian tech companies. And a lot of our tech has gone over to the US. But what this is putting forward, that actually it's not a bad incubator, a bad space to be able to grow your company, and that there are still global exit opportunities available when you choose.
Yeah, it's interesting how the market's kind of changed. Like I remember 2019, ASX was in flavor with Israeli tech companies coming over and doing their IPOs here, and kind of connected to the London Stock Exchange and hearing, you know, some data out of there that it's gone off the boil a bit with local tech companies in the UK not wanting to list on the London Stock Exchange anymore. So it is interesting how these things ebb and flow, but sounds like, how did you describe it? Not a bad place. I wonder if that's their marketing tagline.
I have a sneaking suspicion they won't be paying for that glowing endorsement. Now, one of the risks of being a public company is you get real-time feedback on your results. Did you see what happened to Lyft?
I feel so sorry for the person who made this mistake, the fat finger typo.
I'll put the chart up. But Lyft, after the announcement went out, their shares in aftermarket went from $12 to $20. Because their earnings release has a 500 basis point improvement in margins. Then the earnings call started, I believe, and then it was, sorry, lol, we got that. It's actually 50 basis points divided by 10. So then it crashed down from $20 to $14, but it still ended the day like $16 something. But
that means some people lost some money. Well, if they sold at that, but
this is the US we're talking about. There will be litigation. there's going to be. So anyway, listed environments are not without their risks. So let's keep going with Australian funding. A big shout out to Harris Qureshi, who writes the regular This Week in Aussie Startups. I don't know about you, but I've been following that more and more, but he's done a really great breakdown on some of the money that's been flowing into early stage businesses recently.
Yeah, it's always a great summary. So quick headline was 198 million went into Australian startup funding this week across just four rounds. So that's a big number across four. A big chunk of that was BugCrowd, $156 million round, making them the number one, crowdsourced cybersecurity platform. But BugCrowd, that's another one that's been going for a while now. And yeah, it's starting to see the overnight success becoming mainstream knowledge in the ecosystem.
They describe it as ethical hacking, where you can effectively find people to expose your weaknesses. In my world, I just call them friends.
It's family for me.
Or teammates. Problem is, I provide no shortage of opportunities for those weaknesses to be demonstrated. Eloise Keating of Smart Company provided also a summary that went into each of the companies, and we'll put the link to that in there as well. But yeah, there was BugCrowd, there was Fat Zebra. The amount wasn't provided. But Marco, is that how you would spell it?
I don't know, but it's a deep learning modules to take semantic meaning from images, which I'm really fascinated about.
Yeah. Yeah, they raised $19.4 million. I'm excited by that kind of tech because I don't know about you, but I spend my life screenshotting all sorts of photos or pictures from different social media platforms that have some embedded information that I tell myself I'm going to go back to one day because it's interesting and valuable, and that day never actually comes. So if there was some tech that could actually then pull out and aggregate.
It's so true. Like, this is what I'm most excited about with AI, the amount of content that we consume. I have a reading folder on my desktop that is just growing exponentially that I don't get to. I just want the little AI summary of all of that. But I was just thinking, as we were talking about Marco, I think, Don, we need one for the comments that, you know, listeners make on our posts and other things to interpret. Are they having a slide at me? Just a comment.
It's probably just my oversensitive nature, but sometimes I look at it. Hang on, are you supporting what I'm saying? Are you having a crack at me? And I need to get onto my therapist real quick. And then Hatch raised $7 million in an oversubscribed round led by Rampersand. Got some really interesting backers there. What I find interesting is that even in this day and age, there can be continued evolution and development in platforms for finding people.
Yeah.
And so what they've got customers like Domain, HelloFresh, Uber, Woolworths. So to be able to build something that has a value proposition to attract those brands, that's really impressive. And they're achieving 20% month-on-month growth for the past 2 years.
That's impressive. That's really impressive.
Like, Jack, how many of these do we see pitched? Like some sort of recruitment tool, often for a specific industry. And it's so hard to pick the winner out of that.
Yeah.
If you're wondering what product market fit looks like, 20% month-on-month growth.
For 2 years.
For 2 years. That tells me that there's some great product market fit. So well done. That was founded by the Iconics, Adam Jacobs, and also Zipco's Chaz Heatner. Now, a local company, Gilmore Space,
yeah,
raised another $55 million prior to their first launch at a $605 million valuation.
So good to see. Queensland-based space rocket company. We should try and get them on the potty. They're probably busy building shit.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're probably busy doing functional things to help humanity whilst I discuss my emotional problems. But yeah, no, great to see. The latest funding round values the business at $605 million and was led by existing investors QIC with local venture firms Blackbird and Main Sequence, plus Australian Superfund, Host Plus and Hestia, doubling down on their early investments. And that's what we're seeing more and more of, super funds that are already in the venture space doing direct investments into scale-up companies.
Yeah, even the going back to Canva, like their big secondary sale at the moment is led by, from memory, it's one of the US pension funds. So yeah, increasing amount of capital being deployed by them.
Yeah. So great to see that activity. I think it's like this 2023 doesn't exist from a M&A or big transaction point of view. We're really into some great momentum.
Well, yeah, 2024 it's come out of the gates fast. Like the deal flow, the quality of deal flow, the M&A activity, the round sizes, it feels like game on. Great time to be investing.
Yeah. And with entrepreneurs, it's good to see that they always retain their fight, and putting aside what you may or may not think of Facebook and whether it's good or bad for humanity, like we previously discussed. Did you see the Zuckerberg versus Apple and Zuck doing his review of the Vision Pro?
I love it. I love the fact that it was just him talking to camera, going through it. Like you can just feel that entrepreneurial energy. It wasn't like some professional video from someone on the team. Nah, Zuck himself. And it's got all the vibes of Beta versus VHS. And Jack, I know this might shock you, but we used to have to put cassettes into a machine to watch videos.
Little door would open and you'd put it in and then you'd sit back.
But the lesson from that's always talked about is, you know, the best product isn't necessarily the winner. And yeah, Zuck little piece did focus a lot on the product. As a technical entrepreneur, I get it. But I think for me, what's really interesting at the moment is the use cases that are coming out. Like just some amazing, particularly in the health space.
Yeah, I've shared one with you guys where a doctor's doing brain surgery with these in, and in real time is getting a layered map of where he's operating, different parts of the brain. Like, amazing.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. I still could be convinced to buy a set.
Don, did you end up getting one?
Well, that's on order. I've got to wait. Jack, yeah. I can assure you one thing. You're going to know within seconds.
Yeah.
A whole lot of the world is going to know, and I'll probably be sleeping in the caravan because there's no way my wife will allow me into the house with it. So don't you worry that I'll get it and not share the joy.
Can we get the webcam set up and you dial in so we still get like the view of you with the headset on dialing into a tribe talking? You've got the notes all up in front of me.
just doing the hand movements and doing these ones.
Did you guys see the memes of Zuckerberg on the weekend?
Oh, yeah.
See? Oh, so, my God. They were so funny.
It's so broad.
But one of the best was the one of BT's helping portfolio companies.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys knew, but so Zuckerberg, the fighter that he walked out with the UFC was an Aussie, Volkanovski, which was like awesome. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. He was the champ and he lost, but like it's still pretty cool to see.
Yeah, I love it. Cool. I found an interesting little video unpacking why Google may be going, not Google, Apple is going in the direction it's gone with those Vision Pros, and why Zuck may be missing the point, because Zuck talked about price, functionality, but actually Google is really good at creating demand. I might just play this little video here.
Wait, Doug, I just want to say Apple for that one.
What did I say?
You said Google.
You said Google.
I said Google again. See, this really is the email that I got during the week about the intergenerational banter. It sounds like I'm going full Biden. My brain is just turning to mush. But anyway, I found this. This was one of the original founders of Oculus.
I think Apple's going after the exact right segment of the market that Apple should be going after. So the thing you have to remember is different companies, I think, have different products that are right for them to be building. I think if Apple had tried to go after the low end of the market, that would have been a mistake. They are taking the exact approach that I had always wanted Apple to take, and really the approach that Oculus had been taking in the early years. You know, I actually when Apple launched the Vision Pro, I retweeted a tweet of my own from 2015, where I said that before VR can become something that everyone can afford, it must become something that everybody wants. And I think that's the approach Apple is taking. You know, they're trying to go balls to the wall, the highest possible resolution, the highest quality possible displays, the best possible ergonomics. And they're going all in on that with little regard for it being affordable for everyone. Sure. And I think that is actually the right approach for Apple to take right now. That approach will change. Obviously, they're going to do a cheaper version in the future. It boils my mind when you have all of these pundits coming out and saying, this is a blunder, it'll never go anywhere. Who the heck is going to spend $3,500?
A lot of people.
Well, that's the real secret. There's a lot of people who are going to spend it. But more importantly, there's 100 times more people who are going to spend a quarter of that when it gets to that, to that price. That's really where you need to be looking at this. That the price right now, it's kind of irrelevant. That the people who are going to buy it at $3,500, we would have bought it at $5,000. Sure. We would have bought it at $2,000. The price just doesn't matter for the group of early adopters that they're targeting. But what they're going to do is inspire lust in a much larger group of people who, you know, as I dreamed all those years ago, CVR is something they desperately want before it becomes something they can afford.
Yeah, it's such a good reminder of the tech adoption diffusion curve, like getting those, the buying motivators of the early adopters is very different to the buying motivators of the mass market that follows later. And so what they're doing really well is understanding that piece to create desire with the other customer segments later. So it's a really good point.
Yeah.
And it's a good lesson for founders. You know, often founders default to, we need to be cheaper. We need to be cheaper. We need to be cheaper. But positioning and how that then influences psychology of the buyer is really important to think about.
Mimetic desire is the idea that people desire things because other people they respect desire those things. If you see people you respect buying a Vision Pro, you will subconsciously want a Vision Pro. So that mimetic desire, even in a B2B space, which is where we invest, if you see someone in your industry that you respect and that you feel is like you in terms of their problems and what they're trying to solve, being able to have those great testimonials, being able to have those demonstrations and having those early adopters then create desire for others is absolutely, you know, a goal you should be setting.
So what'll be interesting, Don, if you and I end up wearing these on a podcast, if anyone else actually buys after saying that.
No. It's the opposite. They're like, come on, fuck, I can't look like those.
Can't be seen with it if those guys have it.
Jack decides he's going back to law because this is all just too painful. With this hardware running at a rapid rate, the software and the AI tools is just moving unbelievably. And what also came out during the week was Sora.
It's like every week there is a major step change in AI generative tools. Like Sora is just phenomenal.
Some of the text to video is just incredible.
Absolutely phenomenal. And you know, when you extrapolate that with the VR headset, you can see where all this is going. Like, I'm still convinced we're in the Matrix and this is all a software simulation because we are so close to getting there.
I'll put a thread of some of the best videos online that I've seen, but what are some of the consequences? And there was a great one-liner shared by on a post by Cam Richardson. The most significant consequence of the internet was that it pushed distribution costs down to zero. The most significant consequence of AI is that it will push content creation costs down to zero. Now, he attributes that to Evan Strong from Napkin Math. I think he's right. And like, if you think of the internet in that way, everyone could be reached. From a content creation point of view, the cost of that's going to zero.
Yeah. And yeah, there were some posts there. What does this mean for the future of cinema, for the future of video movie generation, for CGI in action films, for games? There was a great little quote I saw from David Holtz, the founder of Midjourney, talking about the future of gaming, saying that one day gaming consoles will just be a huge AI chip and all the games will be your dreams. You have a thought and it generates the game.
That's going to be scary, weird.
Just fascinating.
I think we keep coming back to it, but it's important for founders and investors to understand what's happening.
Mm.
But just as important, if not more important, is creating a culture and an environment that can digest all this information, that can then make decisions and then react to the change, that can leave the past behind, that can transcend the conflicts that often happen. Maintaining an organizational culture and climate and an individual culture and climate. You see it in individuals as well that can't change, can't adapt. Maintaining that foundational ability is the only way to traverse this ever-increasing change loop.
Yeah, and the other big thing out this week was Google's release of the upgraded Gemini model that can now process 1 million tokens. So massive volume of text basically in an instant. And so the rate at which the data can be consumed to then generate the models is also going through a step change. So we have the hardware step change. We have the essentially like the processing input power of the AI models. And at the same time, these generative tools. And so if you're competing in that space, if you're an AI company trying to compete and find, you know, your unique product offering, that landscape is just like quicksand shifting very fast.
So I've got a number of founder focus and investor focus episodes that are in the can. What I often struggle with is the intro, because we record the session, but for the founder and investor focus ones, trying to do a good introduction that summarizes it without going too deep, but it captures the value of the episode, I always find challenging. Then life gets in the way, and before you know it, weeks have gone past and it's not released. So on the weekend, I thought, I got to pull my finger out. So I went and just took the transcript of the six that are in the can, whacked it into ChatGPT and said, write me an intro in 45 seconds or less of the key messages as to why someone should listen to this. And it actually did a pretty good job. Now, I'm then going to fine tune and I'm going to add some stuff from my recollection, but now I'm over that initial hump and watch out. Podcast world, we're about to have a river of episodes.
We just now need to layer that with the generative, what's the tool that actually replicates you and creates the video from a text? Like, we do that. We've got it all automated for us.
It's interesting. Is this podcast in the end, A, totally irrelevant, but B, just going to be like a thing we type, go and summarize all of the tech news that would be interesting in the manner that we would do it. And we just let it go and it goes and creates this perfect episode based on the audience and what they engage with. Is that where we're heading?
I think so. I think there was a talk by Sam Altman. One little thing I took from it was, in a world where all the information is not just readily accessible, but readily processed and summarized into an insight, the only thing left is hypothesis of new concepts or new ideas. So unless we actually have some unique ideas and thoughts, I think we're out of business.
Do we just pack up now then?
If you zoom out enough, it's all, there's no meaning behind anything, right? If we should just pack up now.
Life is empty and it's meaningless. Meaning it's empty that you can fill it with whatever you want to fill it with. You can choose. It's a big empty bucket and you can fill it with joy. You can fill it with despair. You can fill it with whatever you want. It's empty. It's yours for the taking. And it's meaningless in that if you zoom out to the universe, we're the meaning making machine. So you can allocate whatever meaning you want. And in that basis, I say we fill it as far as we can fill it until the last listener has dropped off. Can we make a deal that we will wait until listenership hits zero and then we'll pull the pin?
Yeah. We're going to Benjamin Button the podcast trajectory, going from one listener to two to three. We're going the other way.
Jack's sitting there going, I'll be fucking long gone before that needs to happen. And so NVIDIA also released Chat with RTX, which is an AI chatbot that runs locally on your PC. It can summarize or search documents across your PC's files and even YouTube videos and playlists. And I don't know about you, but my computer is filled with all sorts of stuff that I find it hard to find, let alone summarize, let alone get some value. And if this was running on my local PC, that'd be pretty rad.
It'd be very rad. I want the version of this that goes through, like you can feed it content and it can text, like you give it a context that you want to listen for and it will summarize specifically for that context. So with all the podcasts we consume, I just want to listen from the lens of an emerging fund manager. Not all the other pieces or perspectives, but as we're talking about all this, I'm conscious of the inherent biases that this is just going to perpetuate. Like we already have a bias in what we choose to listen to and the content we save. And now we're going to be summarizing that information to inform us. And so I almost need the gut check AI tool that goes, hey, from everything you're listening, you've got these blind spots. You're not aware of this. Here's a completely different perspective. Here's some other data sources that you don't have to balance your insane opinions and narrow-minded views.
Yeah. No, I do like that. And where's this all heading? I posted an article in the show notes. I don't know if you had a chance to read it but Michael Jackson, the VC Michael Jackson, he reposted an article of why AI is like water. And in this AI world, tech differentiation is heading to zero. For a long time, tech has been seen as a differentiator amongst software startups. We thought that if you built something that no one else could, that would be enough to protect you. Definitely not forever, but at least for a while. But what we're seeing with AI is that tech provides you basically no protection from the start. Tech differentiation in a world of AI is a shrinking moat.
Is that just because the time to build shortens?
I think so. It's the time to build, the resources you need to build, the complexity of the build, like the ability to actually create something is going to become so fast and so cheap that anyone's going to be able to do it from a point of text.
And if your competitive advantage is the data, well, we've been showing that could be potentially replicated or even manufactured. If your unique value prop is the model, that can be like all these aspects of AI. And, you know, there's been such a rush of capital into AI, and we're possibly the only VC that hasn't actually invested in an AI startup, because I think exactly because of this. This hockey stick, like the exponential growth of technology, how do you actually see where the real value is going to lie and who's going to be the winner?
Yeah. My view is this is what's going to happen. The incumbent models and the incumbent players that already have the capital, they're just going to keep going wider and wider and wider and wider. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no investment opportunities. The investment opportunities for us are the companies that can harness that AI, that can demonstrate founding teams and organizational cultures, that can take that tech and then create moats using the tech that others can't. But going direct into the AI, I'm either too old or don't understand. And so that's going to be a part of the world we miss. And what's your view, Jack, on some of the AI stuff that's been coming across our desk and why we just haven't been able to take a swing at it?
Just with any new category, like we believe in the technology, but we just don't know which is going to be the vehicle that wins. So like our view is it's a super crowded space. It's a new technology that no one really understands who is going to be the winner, and the market's going to determine that. So for us as an emerging manager, like it's a really risky bet for us to take and one that we don't think we can. I just think like we totally believe in the technology. We see a reason why AI is going to be here for the long term, but right now, like we just can't take a punt. And if we believed that the personal computer was going to be here forever, we would have bet on Osborne, and Osborne eventually went bankrupt, and like same applies here. So I just don't think we're in the position to.
Yeah, I think you make a really valid point around our context. We're an emerging manager that emerging managers don't get a second crack if you screw up and don't deliver returns. So we have to be a bit more conservative and be clearer with where we're going to back, because if we fuck this up, we're not coming back.
Yeah.
If you're
like something we do see in like with AI, the market, like the total addressable market is massive. Like it's a really big opportunity in every AI vertical that we seem to look at. So if you're a bigger fund, you are able to take a speculative bet and try and hope that this is the winner that pays off. And we know our game follows the power law. Like there are going to be some very successful investors who are early in AI, but for us, like right now, it's do or die on a deal by deal basis. And for us to try and raise a fund, we need traction. And like we go out there and say, we invested in the text to video to text, or other way around, sorry, like we die, we can't exist.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, going back to the Adrian DeMarco chat last week and how he was talking about how he selects deals and thinks of investing and the nuances of a VC fund. And exactly to your point, Jack, like a big fund, like sometimes the way they talk about it is we need exposure to AI. Like we have to be in this. And it's much more about portfolio, like broad portfolio allocation, almost treating it like AI is an asset class that they need to be exposed to. Whereas, you know, Adrian's point was more, no, deal by deal, look at the fundamentals of the business and the company. And I think for us in our stage of life cycle, but also our really niche focus and you know, part of our value prop is adding value beyond the capital to lift the value of the company. I think it's going to remain true for us. I think we'll always have that lens of backing a good business rather than looking at it as we're going to make a speculative bet in AI just because we want to be in that space.
Let's say that it's true that tech differentiation goes to zero. It's not that there's going to be no opportunity, because the customers that have these problems are still going to have the problems. There's still going to be the opportunity for something. It's just that the tech differentiation disappears. And so what I think that means is that the go-to-market motion and the go-to-market strategy and every component of that go-to-market funnel just becomes incredibly important, or more important. And messaging and value proposition and positioning and all of those.
Yeah, Don, just to add there, I think positioning, like being niche, becomes even more important, because if you're just trying to cater and service everyone, you're going to die. But if you just solve one problem for one sector and go really deep on that, the messaging, everything becomes a lot easier. So at least you have a head start over someone that's trying to be all things to all people.
Yeah. And in honor of the great T Swift landing on our shores, there was something we discussed this week that I figured would be worthy here. I've seen some of these amazing geniuses online that didn't get tickets. So they went and got jobs in the stadium, either as security guards.
That is genius.
Ushers, food, like, I would have been more than happy to do that, but I'm too dumb to have thought that. But anyways, for everyone going, enjoy. But this is an old video from Gary V. We'll explain the connection of why we think this is relevant shortly.
I just think you've got to rethink the entire thing. But to break through the noise, by definition, you have to do something fundamentally different than what everybody else is doing. And everybody else is doing the same thing. I call it the Taylor Swift rule. So I think Taylor Swift hacked culture. I think Kanye does it as well, believe it or not. Here's what they do. You scale the unscalable if you want to break through the noise today. So let me explain. What Taylor Swift's very good at is she knows that when people tweet her and say, Taylor, come to my wedding and sing me a song, she actually does it. Here's why she does it. The 75-minute allocation of her time to do something like that is not ROI positive for Taylor, based on what she makes for her time. However, the amplification of doing something that makes no sense on paper is where she gets all her value. So I get yelled at by all my smartest CEO friends, the most fancy gals and guys on earth, for still answering all these tweets and emails and replying one by one on Snapchat. But I know that depth is far more interesting than width in a world where the width has just become completely obnoxiously loud and impossible to break through. I just think communication's very valuable. Like it just works and just nobody does it. Like, really. I mean, great communicators win in life, especially, you know, back to why I married my wife 5 seconds into our first date, especially if you're lucky enough to find another great communicator. And that's where client relationships and that's where business partnerships go.
Yes, the ability to communicate, the ability to stand out. And we've been discussing internally just with our own go-to-market strategy and how we're using LinkedIn and how we stay within our values of authenticity, but at the same time trying to get some scale. And one of the things we've just been discussing is we've got to be doing the things that don't scale. So then we can then get the amplification. I think that's the key bit. The two things have to go together. It's not just doing things that don't scale. It's doing things that don't scale, but then have that second, third, fourth order effect. And I think a lot of founders don't put a lot of effort into sort of thinking through that. I've certainly fallen into the trap that if it doesn't scale or if it doesn't feel scalable, then I shouldn't be doing it. And T. Swift demonstrates otherwise.
Yeah, amplifying the unscalable. And I think his other point right at the start of that around, you know, your strategy has to be doing what others are not to get cut through in the noise. And, you know, the strategy cascade framework we use and one of the little filters there is making sure that your strategy, the opposite of which is not just the blatantly obvious that everyone is doing. Yeah, it's like great little content piece. I love that. And it is something we talk about a lot, the nature of the VC game. It's face-to-face, it's building trust, it's deep relationships over time. So scaling that is not an easy, intuitive thing. Amplify the unscalable.
Yeah. And Harry Stebbings of 20VC, I mean, he's built, what, the world's greatest VC podcast?
Yep.
And his view is for the first 50,000 Twitter followers, for every one of them, he thanked them personally for following and asked what would they do differently in the podcast. So there are things out there that don't scale. And then there are things that seem to be scaling to the moon.
Like the NVIDIA share price.
Like, yeah. So AI valuations, well, just the whole listed environment, and we're going to get into that a little bit today. But tell you what, turns out to continue to be scaling infinitely. There's been a couple of articles, NVIDIA earning disappointment could send the market into a frenzy. I think that's right. I think when you have a look at it, NVIDIA is like holding this whole space up. And if NVIDIA falters, I can just see the whole thing faltering.
It's an interesting thought. Yeah, the ripple effect.
There's a lot of stuff on Twitter of these people that are making huge amounts of dollars. But if you've been around for a while, it never tends to last. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Well, I'd never heard of before. Super Microcomputer, SMC, is up like 5x in the last few months. What I found very funny was the CEO did an interview, and during the interview, the stock fell 20%.
Imagine if we had real time shareholder sentiment during our podcast episode.
Shit.
Like the worm on Channel 7 during the elections.
What's that saying? It's best to just keep your mouth shut and have people maybe think they're an idiot than open your mouth and remove all doubt or something like that. I think that was told to me at me once, but it's going to be interesting to see, and we'll get into some of the market dynamics. But a couple of people have put forward in terms of NVIDIA's price is when you dig into their earnings, one of the things that collapsed Cisco originally was that they were doing a lot of vendor financing and putting it on the balance sheet as revenue and income, onto the P&L, sorry. But then when all those companies shit the bed, they had to do a huge amount of write-offs. NVIDIA, apparently, according to these people, is undertaking the same activities. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out, because history never repeats exactly, but it does rhyme. And Cisco was the backbone of the internet and was going to go on forever. And there was a Financial Times article by Toby Clothier, and he put together a discounted cash flow, which I know is old school because it relies on, you know, actually making money in the future. But he said, in order to get to today's 740 share price with a standard discounted cash flow model requires that the company maintain their monopolistic position of 55% operating margins for the next decade and grow sales tenfold from $60 billion a year to $600 billion a year. So we've got to go 10x in sales and maintain monopolistic margins so nobody else comes out with any of this. Now, for context, the entire industry sold $600 billion worth this year. So not saying it's not possible. It's just saying, understanding that if you're paying today's price for NVIDIA and you want to get a return at some point, you have to believe that 55% margin can be maintained for hardware and it's going to grow 10x. If you believe that, go for gold.
Yeah. At a time when Sam Altman is trying to get $7 trillion to build a competitor.
And what tends to happen is, especially in hardware, those margins just don't last. They end up being a commodity product. And what seemed like something amazing and cool ends up being commoditized and just becoming incredibly basic. You've only got to look at our phones and cameras and digital cameras and all that kind of stuff. It just, software and other competitors tend to eat the world. I've referenced Cisco a couple of times and what happened to Cisco after the last.com. And I'd like to just read the words of the CEO in 2002. So a couple of years after the crash, I think it had dropped by like 95%. And he had a quote to the shareholders, at 10 times revenue, to give you a 10-year payback, I have to pay you 100% of revenues for 10 straight years in dividends. That assumes that I can get my shareholders to agree to that. That assumes I have zero cost of goods sold, which for a hardware company is difficult. That assumes zero expenses, which is really hard with 40,000 employees. That assumes I pay no taxes, which is very, very hard. And that assumes you pay no taxes on your dividends, which is kind of illegal. And that assumes with zero R&D for the next 10 years, I can maintain the current revenue rate. Now, having done all that, would you like to buy my stock at $64? Do you realize how ridiculous those basic assumptions are? You don't need transparency. You don't need any footnotes. What were you thinking? Now, that's him talking about shareholders buying his shares at 10 times revenue. NVIDIA is currently at about 66 times revenue. History doesn't repeat exact, it rhymes. I just throw that out there into the mix.
I remember when I was young and just learning about financial markets, and a mentor said to me, beware when anyone says, this time it's different, or it's different because, and this just rings true. I hadn't seen this quote before, but that is bloody marvelous.
So I don't want to be the person to say this time it's different, but we did see that graph in the presentation at the 10/13 Christmas party. What are your thoughts now considering that?
It's a really good point. We're living in an exponential world. So what Jack's referring to, it was just a graph that showed that the more development dollars that go into AI and hardware, the return continues to accelerate. There's like no ceiling that has been found at the moment. And I guess what you're saying is, in a world of almost that exponential nature, is it different this time?
It's a very valid question.
My view is they're two different things. What we're talking about is NVIDIA's ability at that growth rate to maintain margins, to create profitability, that no competitors come in. We're talking about the market capitalization of one stock. I think the two things can coexist. We can still have that chart. But I guess what I'm saying is, in order for that chart to fulfill, I just think more people come into the space.
Yeah, but the point with that is, if you keep piling money into your model is going to, like, there's going to be a linear increase.
Yeah, but NVIDIA is the hardware that drives the model. So the underlying thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That the model might have that defensibility, but we're talking about the silicon.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. That's
true. Business.
But a really good point. What I thought would be interesting is, I've been collecting a few charts as I do, and we haven't subjected listeners to this in a little while.
No, there's a backlog of charts.
So let's just share screen again, and we're going to try and do the best we can for the listeners so we don't leave them behind. So there's a contextual piece that we need to understand, that there's a big difference between active management, so people that believe that they can beat the market by making decisions to buy and sell, versus passive investment, which is just, I'm going to buy the index. And the chart that I've just put up from year 2000 all the way through to now is that the percentage of the passive industry just keeps going up and to the right, and that the active funds is going down and to the right. And so the price really is made at the margins of buyers and sellers. the middle that hold on, they're slightly irrelevant. But at the margins, if more passive, and what's another way of saying passive? Well, it's, I don't care about the price. I have money, I buy. I need money, I sell. If you think of the Australian superannuation industry, every year we just keep having new money go into the super system that has to go somewhere. A lot of it's going into VC. A lot of it goes into passive strategies where I don't care about the underlying, I just buy the index. What we're seeing is a lot of that passive is also flowing into what they call the Magnificent Seven. So if we look at back to 2019, the percentage of the seven meme stocks, so the seven meme stocks are Google, Apple, Nvidia, Tesla, all of those, that percentage that makes up the market continues to get larger and larger. So what that means is the price of the overall market indexes is actually becoming more reliant on a smaller and smaller number of stocks. As long as those stocks keep going up and to the right, all these retail investors invested in that are going to be fine. If we find like other cycles, they start to go down to the right, a few people are going to probably be in trouble. But I'm not upset by this because strong public markets tend to flow into strong private markets. Our investors that have big share portfolios that are doing well, that have good paper wealth, they tend to open their wallets to more of the illiquid private stuff. So I'm personally, as we are, incentivized to hope this merry-go-round goes on indefinitely. The problem is that's not really how life tends to go. So if we were to look at those seven, the total returns, Nvidia's up 152% since 22, Meta's up 41, Microsoft's up 24. The SPY overall is up 8. Note that Tesla's down 46%. That's because it's not actually a high margin tech company, may I suggest. It's a low margin auto company, but we can get to that a little bit later. So everyone seems to be, you know, up and to the riding. A couple of interesting things I found. So Bill Gates, who's seen a few cycles, has actually done a hell of a lot of selling and has reduced his portfolio by 65%. When you have a look at, he's held his Microsoft, he's only reduced it by 2.7%. So I guess you have to if you're Bill. But if you have a look at all the other tech companies, he's been selling positions, sell 100%, sell 100%, sell 100%. Now it's not just Bill. Here is the percentage of corporate insider sellers. So these are people employed by these listed companies and the amount of selling from 2023 through to January 2024. And you can see now that it's well out of its normal average. It has spiked up of a lot of insiders starting to sell. When a group of people with all the inside information that know their forecasts, that can see the pipeline, when that starts to double and triple, I'd start to get a little bit intrigued. One of the biggest sellers is Mr. Bezos, $6.5 billion worth of cash into his pocket in the last few weeks. I wonder if he's looking for any emerging fund managers to come.
Well, when the crew of the Titanic are jumping ship, it's a bit of a sign there.
So anyway, it's interesting. Yeah, Bill and these others may not be buying the whole soft landing business. And when you look at the top 10% of stocks by size versus the entire US market, so this chart goes back to 1926, you can see that it's never really gone past that 75%, the top 10% of stocks by size of the entire market. Now we are at a higher percentage than we were at the last tech bubble in 99.
Yeah, bigger than the dot-com bust.
Bigger than the dot-com bust. Now, I'm not making a hypothesis that we've got a crash coming or whatever. I'm just laying out a little bit of data that I find interesting. The problem that I mentioned earlier on, if a bigger and bigger part of the market is passive and they don't care about price and they just buy, as long as we've got inflows, we're going to be cool. The second that we get outflows, i.e. people wanting their money back, then we're going to see that opposite whipsaw. Now, a lot of people out there have started to say, well, now we've got higher interest rates and we haven't had recession, we're out of the woods. Another great T-Swift song. But I'm not sure we are out of the woods, because if you have a look at yield curve inversion. So I've just put a chart up of the 210s. We haven't had our recession post our yield curve inversion yet. Now, maybe it's different this time. Not saying that it isn't different this time, but it's just probably a little bit too early to celebrate and party that actually everything's going to be up and to the right. In my humble opinion, not financial advice. I'm just somebody sharing some slides. Now, what I look out for is the canary in the coal mine is looking at volatility, both in the bond market and in the equity market. And what we're seeing at the moment, here's the equity spikes post the dot-com crash, post the GFC, post COVID. There is these little early warnings when volatility in both markets starts to spike, meaning the daily ranges of share prices and bond prices starts getting bigger and bigger. We're seeing a really depressed volatility at the moment. Now, it's going to be interesting to see what NVIDIA's earnings do, because that could start off a bit of a volatility flight. I'm just saying, just keep an eye on it. Now, one of the interesting things is the relationship between interest rates, long duration assets, and what they call the pivot. So here's a chart that goes back to pre-1999, so the last tech cycle. And what you'll notice about interest rates is when they start putting up interest rates and then they pause putting up, for the listeners at home, they have to start cutting like very quickly after.
Yeah.
Why do they cut? Because often these central banks, they tighten too much because they're looking at rearview mirror. They tighten too much and then they kill the place. So then they have to respond with very fast easing. But you'll see the last few times that the Fed had to cut rapidly, it was in response to dying economies and market conditions. And look at what the share markets did. They fell significantly. And what happened just before it shitting the bed? The yield curve inverted. Now, okay, maybe this time it's different. Maybe this time there is no informational value in it, but we are at record multiples, record highs, driven by a narrative, which is AI is going to solve everything. Right when we've increased interest rates on a percentage basis, amazingly, once the Fed pivot does happen and interest rates do fall and the economy washes itself out, you'll see that actually tech then does quite well. So you got to be careful not to try and time the market. It's more time in the market. One of the fascinating areas as well is that Bitcoin has actually been really good at sniffing out some of these trends. And Bitcoin isn't just a group of kids in their basement. It's an institutional place now. And so Bitcoin isn't far off its all-time high. It's really been rocketing up. And there's a guy on Twitter called Plan B that talks about the daily stock to flow ratio. And I think that stock to flow ratio isn't just a Bitcoin issue. It's actually something that's seen in a range of different asset classes where there's really low stock to flow. So I take Noosa property prices. It now, to buy into Noosa Parade on the river, it's now 20 million. Last cycle, it was 8 million. The cycle before that was 4 million. Like, I've been going there for nearly 30 years and it just always keeps going up. And the thing is, when you have an asset class where no more can be made that has a level of desire to people, you find disproportionate returns in that. And that's why high quality property always outperforms, say, units. You can just build more units. And there's always, once some margin comes into it, these developers come in and they build more units. But when it comes to high-end property that can't be replicated, acreage, waterfront, that's where you see the disproportionate returns. And I think the same thing plays out in Bitcoin. Now, on a log chart, if you have a look at the last three halvings, so 2012, that chart shows up to $100. Then it falls down and shits itself. Then the next one was from a few dollars all the way up to what? Nearly 8,000. Then the COVID one was around the 8,000 mark all the way up to 60,000. And now Are the same patterns going to play out? I don't know. Just an interesting chart. And what's become a tailwind for Bitcoin is now the SEC has legalized ETFs. And what's an ETF? It's a place for passive investors to go and dump money. So if you have a look at that middle chart and the top chart, so look at the weekly amounts of money cumulatively flowing into Bitcoin ETFs. So even if you don't believe in Bitcoin, even if you believe it's bullshit, there is this tailwind at the moment where all of these retail dollars are being exchanged for the purchasing of Bitcoin, which allegedly has a fixed amount available. And if that chart keeps going up and to the right in a world of greater and greater passive investment, what's that going to do to price for a fixed asset? Now, what sometimes Bitcoin is sniffing out is when interest rates start to fall. And so there's a lot of people saying that interest rates have tamed inflation. Well, actually, here's some charts that show that inflation in a lot of areas, so supply chain, the property, manufacturing, is showing that yes, inflation started to come down in 22 into 23, but actually it's starting to re-accelerate some areas. Now, this could just be a reverse trend within the larger trend of decreasing, but those that are crowing from the rooftops that inflation is gone and interest rates are going to fall, be a little bit careful. We'll see how it plays out. I'll put all of these charts in the show notes. Any thoughts?
I love it. Always love a good Don chart session. I was while you were talking before, I was looking up the VIX, and at the moment it's relatively low. So VIX is a precursor, but what's the precursor to the VIX in your opinion, Don?
What is the precursor to the VIX? Well, theoretically, the precursor to the VIX is stuff happening at individual stock level, and stuff happening at individual stock level is all to do with sentiment, flows, economic sales, all of that. And that's the bit that is a massive big data mine that I'm sure AI will start to solve. I don't have an answer of what are the easy things to follow. To the VIX. Bond markets tend to sniff out things earlier than the equity markets. That's what happens time and time again. I think with COVID, the stock market didn't break until Feb. I put my first bond trades on, I think in December 19, when it was like, something's going to happen here. But again, if you think of a passive environment that doesn't give a shit about what's happening elsewhere, it just buys, then a lot of that normal information that active managers would have been looking at starts to become irrelevant until the weir breaks, until the selling is greater than the passives. And then the passives start saying, hang on a minute, I want some money back. And they then start having to sell. So I actually think we're going to end up in a world with a lot more volatility. Because when everything's good, more people are going to be buying irrelevant of price. And then when things are not so good, there's going to be a lot more selling irrelevant of price. So look, there's a spew of data and spew of information. And we unfortunately have to drop off. Not unfortunately, I'm excited because we've got our monthly catch up with our offsite participants where we support them post the offsite and go into how they're traveling, what do they need help with, where they're up to, all of that kind of jazz. So we've got everyone joining for that in 6 minutes.
6 minutes. That was a packed episode.
What are we looking forward to?
Well, I realized that I'm going to Mackay this weekend to facilitate MacHack, which was postponed from last year. And I may have forgotten to put it in the calendar.
But just realized.
So I'm looking forward to that. What about you, Jack?
I haven't got any plans. I don't think I have any plans this weekend. So wait and see.
I don't have any plans. I'm in the garden. My soon-to-be brother-in-law is coming up to help with some of the setting up of stuff, so my back will be broken. So I'm looking forward to that. All right, good. We'll see you next time. Hey.
We hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you're a sophisticated investor under Australian law, we'd welcome you to sign up to our investor syndicate, where we'll notify you of investment opportunities as they come up. If you're a B2B founder and think Tribe would be a fit for you, go to Get Capital page of our website. And whether you're a founder or an investor, if you're looking to take your early stage investing or company to the next level in 2024, consider joining one of our offsites or US and UK market entry missions occurring in February, March, May, June, August, and November.
So the first thing is I really appreciate the email.
I really appreciate the feedback from listeners. And I think for us, always doing that gut check. Like, so for anyone listening, always love to hear your opinions. Like, please send it all through. It gives great content for discussion, but also just for ourselves. We're all on this learning journey, so thank you.
Where to begin?
Well, toxic positivity. Do we believe it's a thing? Yes. I think it can be toxic.
Yeah. And this email has been really good to get me to reflect. I guess I have what's that saying? Is it a Mark Twain one or whatever? The greatest time in a person's life is when they work out what they're here to do, or I've totally butchered that, but when you find your calling or whatever. This isn't the Transparent Intelligent podcast, but I love working with founders.
Yeah.
I love working with founders. I've always wanted to get into venture capital because then it's a deploying of capital, working with founders, but there's the selection aspect. There's the supporting aspect. And for me, all of these things rely on patterns. And so I think that some patterns are positive and they're patterns that you should jump on board with. And there are some patterns that are negative and they're patterns that you should jump off with. But maybe before we get into that, you know, short selling in itself has a lot of loaded aspects around it. And so to give an overview for people that may not be fully aware, shorting or short selling, you're borrowing the item. Let's say you're borrowing it at $10 and then you say, thank you. And then you go and sell it. So you get your 10 bucks. Now you've then got to buy it back at some point because you've got to give it back to the person. And so if you can buy it back at $4, well, you've made that six. Now, if it jumps to $20, then you've got to buy it back at 20. You've got to find another $10 somewhere. You've lost 10. So that's now I don't really do it that way. I use the options market, which is even trickier because not only do you have to be right, you've got to be right within the time frame. And that's often what gets me. Now, shorting, going short, is actually a big part of the risk management framework of our entire financial system. And during the global financial crisis, when shares were going down and down and down and down, the SEC went, right, no more shorting. And then it accelerated and had even bigger drops because if you can't short, you can't hedge. If you've got this big asset group over here, but you want to protect your downside and go short, you take that away, people go, oh, well, then I'm better off in cash. So then the selling actually accelerated and regulators didn't understand that. Now, no company that has been or is shorted, as in people borrowing to sell, has ever gone broke because directly of the shorting. Companies' share prices are not relevant to the companies unless you need capital. Now, shorting and what's often known as either a short and distort attacked or activist investing, second order effects can occur that destabilize the company, trust is lost in the company, customers leave, key staff leave, revenues disappear. Suddenly we now need cash, but because of the reputational damage, the shareholder support isn't there, and then it disappears. And that's why it's important to have regulation, that this core part of the financial system is important, but used wrongly, used unethically, used improperly, can cause damage to all groups. And that's why regulation and controls are important. My view is if I can take a bullish view on something, why can't I take the opposite side and sell it first? Now, in reflecting on that, though, I guess the bit that I'm unpacking here is that me talking about how I have a negative view on something, does that mean that I'm anti-founder and therefore I'm not a trustworthy investor and therefore I would scare founders away? It's a valid question. I'm intrigued in your thoughts.
Yeah, it's a really valid question. And I'd love to hear from other listeners, on this exact point. But just going back to the shorting, and I think there's one thing as a financial instrument for risk management, there's one thing if you see a company, and like I used to have call and put options in cycles on Qantas because it was such a predictable cycle. Did I wish bad upon Qantas at any point during that? No. I wish bad on them for other reasons at other points. But I think, there's a difference between using these instruments and then what we've seen in markets sometimes is short selling attacks or trying to bring a company down.
But let's be fair, I do attack Elon.
We attack Elon.
No time for him. If you gave him an enema, you could bury him in a matchbox. Like, I am not Elon positive.
No.
But Don, when you short, or like the reason for shorting is for financial reasons, it's not to see the company fail.
And on the first order effect, my shorting of them can't make the company fail.
Yeah.
The company's business model, the company's lack of cash flow, the company's inability to wash its own face, that will lead to the company fail. But me selling shares first that I borrowed or taking a put option out can't do that.
But on the same train of thought, you short to make a financial gain, which is the same as you invest in startups to see a financial gain.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when I go long a startup, I'm hoping the thing goes up.
And be fair to say, you do much more on the long side than the short side, right?
Yeah, anything I'm doing on the short side is more of a hobby or a personality flaw. Let's not. Stocks can go up infinitely.
Yeah.
So you can make an incredible amount of money on the upside, but you can lose everything on the downside. And going short has destroyed a lot of people's financial position and their reputations.
And the nature of the game we play in, we are backing what we believe are the winners, which inherently applies that there are other companies in that competitive landscape that we don't believe will win. And so it's almost like we naturally have to have the view that some are better than others, or that some stand a greater chance than others. We don't wish bad on those others, but we are in the game of picking winners. And I think the other thing, I mean, going back to what you said, Don, about we love working with founders, I mean, the whole nature and genesis of Tribe is operators, even in our investor syndicate, ex-entrepreneurs who are very interested in helping founders. When I think of our shareholders, even backing people more so than treating this like a financial product class, the amount of time we give to supporting founders, but that doesn't exclude us from also calling things out that other founders could learn from in the mistakes that are made. I mean, from our own experience, when we run a mission or an offsite and we share our own fuck-ups and failures and incompetencies, that is always the number one most positive piece of feedback we receive is how valuable that piece is. The lessons from the downside, not the upside.
People that demand high standards of others need to demand it of themselves. And I think we're pretty good of leaning in with our screw ups and fuck ups. But the thing here is saying it on one side of life, taking a negative view and trying to profit from it, would that make us bad investors on the other side? So it's something to reflect on. And why I'm short Tesla is for just some, and at this point in time, there's some market cycle stuff. I believe half their stuff is bullshit. The stuff that goes into their accounting aspects, and there's just some pattern recognition stuff from the life cycle, like what we talked with Canva. And so I'm applying my experience and interest, and I'm hoping in a manner that then also shares some contrarian insights with others that people go, huh, I thought it was black. Maybe there is a different way to look at something. I just think that is valuable. And then in terms of Elon as a human, I think there are some aspects that I personally dislike. And this is where Bronwyn's article about toxic positivity, if I'm going to play in this ecosystem and therefore be founder friendly, do I need to be positive towards all founders and all behaviors all the time? There's another level back. We don't have to get so whatever. There's another level back of only be positive about the positive things and just keep your mouth shut about the negative things. That's the middle ground, I guess. But I personally believe that Elon's style and decisions supported by his board leads to the premature death of credulous people. I have a negative view on that, which then leads into the stock. But I guess the question is, should it be discussed publicly?
Yeah, I think your point, I mean, it's highly nuanced. And I know later in this episode, we'll talk about NVIDIA. I mean, great founder, great company, doing incredibly well. Would I be investing in it right now at the current share price and the multiples? No.
No, but I wouldn't be shorting it either.
No, I wouldn't
be shorting it. One way to get your face ripped off.
Yeah, but the point is, we can distinguish what makes a good investment from what makes a good business or a great founder And there's a time element to those things. There's a cycle element. There's a life cycle element to those things. Yeah. But yeah, it is a good question. Like, and I would love the feedback. You know, should we be talking about the negative aspects, or should it all be rainbows, unicorns, and sunshine?
The other thing I was reflecting on is I think the answer to this question is you've got to then search in yourself a little bit. And there's actually a values worldview. I was reflecting because there's some views of the world that if you don't like what I've got to say, you can go and get stuffed. I don't really have that kind of view. For me, I'm optimizing more for one of my great mentors who unfortunately passed away. He said to me, if you look after the company can then look after you, but it has to be in that sequence. If you put yourself in the center and everything revolves around you, the company never gets what it needs. And then a company really is just a series of relationships that form, and either we can stay together or we can't. And so my worldview and my value system is optimizing for, well, what's in the best interest of those relationships and what's in the best interest of the company. And so if we get further listener feedback that it is actually a bad look, it turns people off. And ultimately, this podcast is about trying to help founders. But let's be honest, it's trying to attract great founders, and it's trying to provide insights to investors so they understand why we might be backable as a team. So for me, I'm trying to optimize for that, and I'm happy to then stop doing it.
No, I completely agree. If this type of content isn't serving those values, then yeah, we'd love the feedback and we can adjust. But on that point, you know, we're also, the counter to that is we're not here to serve Elon or Tesla.
No.
And we're trying to extract value for our founders and investors by talking about the mistakes others make.
Jack, what's your view? You often are dragged along, especially on my hobby horses. What are your views of the stuff that gets kicked around?
Oh, I think comparing public and private markets are separate issues. And if anyone, like if someone's to say that is a negative look on founders looking at Tribe, I would disagree, just because we're an emerging manager. We can't afford not to support a company. We have a fiduciary duty to our investors to support our portfolio companies. So if Tribe invests in you, we can guarantee 100% conviction, and like we are 100% rooting for you.
And not mistaking that 100% conviction means also having the hard conversations that are, it's not all positive in the sense of what we talk about. The intent is always positive with our portfolio companies.
And I think the how as well. I think the way we try and do it, although I will admit there's been times where I probably didn't cover myself in glory in the moment. But if you put the relationship first, if you put trust and you put respect, you can then have a conversation afterwards and admit where you are wrong.
The only lens I'd put in, I think upside versus downside, like just always bring it back to that. And so if you measure upside and downside, often, I mean, we would never talk about one of our portfolio co's issues in a really public light. We just wouldn't do that. We might share the lessons from it in a non-identifiable way. We do, going back to your point, we value the relationship. We value high trust and respect, because if we start to breach those things, then our ability to influence and add value is absolutely diminished.
And so people that aren't in our portfolio that do come to us for assistance, that we engage with and help, there are times where I and you will say, I was having a chat with a founder about a particular issue, could be conflict, could be strategy, the beginning of this actually talking about the challenges of enterprise sales. Are we then being disingenuous that we're happy to take those issues of others out, but not happy to take our own? Is there a line there?
I think there's a line, but I think it depends. To me, it's what the issue is, and then in the how it's communicated.
Yeah, but it depends what you're optimizing for.
Yeah.
Well, we're asking for some feedback. Would be interested.
Absolutely. And any other feedback on the other random stuff we talk about each week, that would be great as well.
All feedback welcome.